So I will begin our talk here. So for the sake of Bob, who posts our recordings on the website, I will give you the name of this of this talk. I'm calling it Save Yourself, the Lotus Sutra Parable of the Burning House. So, many of you may be familiar, some of you may not, with the Lotus Sutra. This is a Mahayana Buddhist text that was compiled over the course of about 150, 200 years, right around, so like probably starting in the first century BC through about 150 CE. So it's one of those ancient texts that like nobody wrote, you know, no single author. It's just something that grew kind of organically. So it's one of the earliest Mahayana sutras and arguably the most popular Mahayana sutra in the world. And it's used in many different forms of Buddhism. And there's a radical change, if you're not familiar, that from the suttas, the original scriptures of Buddhism, like including but not limited to the Pali Canon. So those were scriptures that were passed down by the oral tradition for a long time and then finally written down. And these are the discourses of the Buddha, and they have a particular flavor. They're usually very you know, kind of down to earth and rational, and the Buddha taught this, and they're about the teachings and practices. And then the Mahayana sutras get very kind of more transcendent. There's multiple Buddhas. There's Buddhas sitting on lotus thrones who can see out into myriad different universes, each one of which has a Buddha. So it gets kind of psychedelic in a way. It has a lot more about devotion. It's a lot of different aspects to the Mahayana sutras, and I won't go into a lot of that right now, but just to kind of introduce the Lotus Sutra, these early Mahayana sutras, because they were such a departure from the original scriptures, they spent a lot of time explaining themselves, explaining how this was legitimate Buddhism, how these really were the words of the Buddha. So they do a lot of justifying themselves in a way. So if you do happen to read the Lotus Sutra, you'll notice that it talks a lot about the Lotus Sutra. It talks a lot about itself. And it talks a lot about how important it is and what a significant teaching this is, and how significant it is the Buddha's giving the Lotus Sutra, and how fortunate you are to be hearing the Lotus Sutra, and the Lotus Sutra this, and then it's kind of like, okay, so when are we going to get to the Lotus Sutra? What is it teaching? So it's a little baffling sometimes, but if you stick with it and you work with it, it has its own kind of language, its own kind of imagery. I mean, it's very ancient. You don't read it expecting to just be like, all right, here's what you do if you want to do Buddhist practice. It's a little different. So that's part of what we'll explore today. It has one of the defining features of it is it has a whole bunch of different parables, and we will be talking about one of them today. So these parables, are stories, you know, of course, just like in other traditions, that illustrate something. And most of the parables in the Lotus Sutra have to do with what in Mahayana Buddhism we call skillful means. So if we want to liberate beings, how do we go about it? As we know, if you are a teacher, if you are a parent, it's not so simple to get a message across. It's not just a matter of just saying what's true and then, oh, okay, now they get it. You have to be skillful. You have to think of who are you talking to? What are they ready to hear? How do you adapt your message? How do you stay and be engaging? All these kinds of things. So this is where the skillfulness comes in. So the Lotus Sutra talks a lot about skillful means in that Mahayana Buddhism itself, the whole approach that it takes could be seen as skillful means, as a way to reach sentient beings. So the parables have a lot to do with the skillful means and how to get through to be sentient beings. So the Buddha says, just before in the Lotus Sutra, just before he tells this parable of the burning house, he explains to Shariputra, his main disciple, "Let me once again make this meaning still more clear through a parable. For intelligent people can understand through parables." So as I share and we discuss this parable, I encourage us to look at it a little bit like poetry, in the sense that the story may evoke certain things in us, and that is something to be paid attention to. It's not necessarily just a linear interpretation that we're looking for. And also I want to try to approach it a little bit like dreams. So my Dharma sister, Sato Martin, who's done guest talks at Bright Way sometimes, she's a lay Zen teacher who's got a sangha down in Eugene. And she's done a lot of dream work outside of Zen, but then she's also found ways to bring it into Zen practice. And she talks about when you have a dream and you want to reflect on it, you want to learn something from it, that you dream your way into it. So rather than kind of sitting back and, oh, this happened and that happened, this probably means that and that probably means that, that you kind of imagine yourself in that setting again. And what, you know, what are the implications of the way things are unfolding? How does this feel? And then also to not just take the point of view of the protagonist, the main protagonist, but of all the other aspects of the dream, all the other pieces, because it's all just you, right? It's all just you processing stuff and telling yourself stuff. So if you can imagine yourself into the different aspects of the dream. So in approaching a parable this way, it's like, maybe this is kind of like a communal dream. There's a story here that has implications that we can explore. So I'll read just like a paragraph or two of the parable and then pause and we can reflect on it a little bit. So it starts off, the Buddha is saying, "Shariputra, suppose in a village or city, in a certain kingdom, there was a great elder. He had many fields, houses, and servants. His house was large and spacious, but had only one gateway. Many people lived in the house, 100, 200, even 500 in all. Its halls and rooms were old and decaying, its walls crumbling, its pillars rotting at the base, its beams and rafters falling down and dangerous." So if you can imagine, this is, you know, this is a dream that you've had and you're explaining this to somebody. Then there was this house and it was like the guy is rich, so he's got this really big house, but the house is all like decaying and falling down, and the, you know, the beams are rotting. So I invite you to reflect on what what this means, what this signifies. What are some of the implications of this setting? So go ahead. You think about it, just unmute yourself and make some observations about this decrepit old house.
What comes to mind to me is that 500 people live there and it's falling apart. Can't somebody help with that? That's what comes to mind.
I'm kind of
stuck. Go ahead.
I was thinking about only one gateway and 500 people. And it seemed like you couldn't get in and out. Or it would be too crowded.
Yeah. Vin?
I was thinking they had wealth, but weren't using it to maintain what they had. Granted, it's controlled by the elder, but that just seems very odd. And also the single gate seemed odd, but yeah.
What it made me think of is that there's just impending doom, foreboding. Now, everybody's kind of living and not doing anything about it, but destruction's headed there.
Yeah, I guess what it made me think of is I really like old Gothic literature, and they're almost always set in these giant mansions built by, you know, these very, very rich patriarchs who are now usually dead or very, very old. And yet it's the symbol of wealth, but it's like decay has crept in. You know, you think of anything written by like Poe, for example, like The Fall of the House of Usher. And it's this great house, but you look closely and everything's really falling apart. And so it's much more of a reflection of the mind state, you know, that things, maybe he's so caught up on fame and glory and riches that he doesn't realize that all the things that really matter, that those foundations are rotting away from under him because he's not really focusing on what's important.
Yeah. Description invokes images of squatters to me. And why are these people squatting in their own home?
Ruth Ann?
Yes, it's kind of a hierarchy of the wealthy older man. And in feudal times, they only had one gate for security. But it's not a community spirit. It's kind of like our country letting a handful of people or one controlling element run everything. And everyone else is almost mesmerized by a failing system. But it seems to lack heart at the system.
It's so rich. I thought about how the kind of reflected on already, but just like the kind of the sense of deception, almost like the decay, like on the surface it might look good or safe, but you know, the decay is there and it's actually dangerous.
It does sound really familiar somehow. It just feels that way.
And then if we imagine ourselves not just, you know, this is something I might, you know, Sato's encouraged me to do with my dreams, and it's like, oh yeah. And then if we imagine ourselves, so we've kind of imagined ourselves as the, in a way, of the residents of the house or observing the residents in the house, but how about the owner of the house? If we are the owner of the house. Or we are the house.
Yeah, I like that. For some reason, I take this very personally. The story is very, very personal, and it is because I'm getting older. The foundations of the house and the pillars are starting to rot. You know, things are coming undone. I have indeed more than 500 entities living inside me. You know, I have like gazillions of them. And I feel I'm very rich, but it's not the kind of riches that would necessarily repair the house or the body or, you know. So anyway, that's kind of how I saw the thing.
Yeah, I think I saw it very much like you described, Domio, which the outside looks good, but on the inside, things are falling apart. And there's a deception involved, which I think is a big part of the world. But this idea that even for myself, like trying to look a certain way and then inside not really doing the work, you know, it's almost like it would be better for the inside to have a strong foundation and the outside not to look as good, because at least the inside is solid.
Yeah.
And it won't fall down on top of these 500 people.
If I could put just one other side of this, if you think of a house as in the house of David or the house of Usher, the house meaning the settlement or the community or the tribe as being the house, and there's only one way in and one way out of being a member of this community. And the foundation, I think, I'm not sure who said foundation, that was a good catch, as well as the timbers that hold up the whole place are becoming decrepit. And if you think of that as being the total society, not just a structure, but the fabric of society is falling apart, that becomes even more alarming.
Yeah. And then also the, you know, in a sense we can blame the, you know, this rich elder who isn't taking care of his house and thereby endangering all the people. But if we imagine ourselves in his place, and, you know, maybe we just don't know how to take care of it. Maybe it seems like too much to take care of. Why, maybe we ourselves don't even know why it's so decrepit. You know, there's a sense, you know, as we'll see, that the elder does care. So to move on to the next paragraph. So all over the house, at the same moment, fire suddenly broke out, engulfing the house in flames. The children of the elder, say 10, 20, or even 30, were in this house. The elder, seeing this great fire spring up on every side, was very alarmed and thought, "Though I can get out safely through the flaming gateway, my children are in the burning house, enjoying themselves, engrossed in play. Without awareness, knowledge, alarm, or fear, fire is closing in on them. Pain and suffering threaten, but they do not care or become frightened, and have no thought of trying to escape." So as I imagine myself into that dream scenario again, and I'm, you know, telling my husband the next day, and then like this fire broke out, and all there was all these kids, and there's too many, like, to take out one by one, but they're all caught up in their play. As if the house wasn't dangerous enough. Now there's a fire that's broken out. So again, what are the implications here? What is this story telling us, communicating?
Seems to me like a perfect representation of the definition of samsara, that's really the situation we're in.
The elder realizes immediately that it's not going to be enough to save himself. He wants to save everybody all at once.
To me, I think about how interesting it is that old human texts and scriptures end up being so prophetic sometimes, where, you know, if our society, if our house had all this decay and was already a little screwed up, and now the world's on fire. I mean, now we have the threat of global heating that could, you know, be a problem that brings the end of us. So now we have, like, it's not just, you know, things were risky, but now the threat is imminent. Now what are we going to do? So in terms of imagining ourselves, we imagine ourselves as the father. We imagine ourselves as the children. So what is our experience if we're the children in this scenario?
Well, I'm having the sense that as the children, you know, they're sort of in their own world. They're being taken, they feel as if they're being taken care of, that there's nothing to worry about. But there's also the implication that they're kind of living in an illusion, that they're unable to see that things are decaying around them. They're not present or really looking at you know, the house or anything about them. They're very caught up in their own daily routines. So it's just a way of looking at it.
Another way of looking at it from my standpoint is the gate or the doorway is the entrance and exit from heaven or from existence. So if the house has this one gate, that's the only way you get in and out of the house, is through this gateway to and from heaven. And the fire, in some analyses, is a smoky fire, and that is the fire of passion, of physical passion for each other. And of course, the children, they're not going to be worried. They're too busy having fun with each other in this passionate embrace. And so they are ignoring the collapse of the building, because they're having too much fun to pay much attention to the realities that are all around them. That's just another analysis. Not knowing what the next paragraph is going to say, I must say, it's kind of difficult to really get into this too deep, because you don't know what's coming up.
I I guess another take on the fire is when I started thinking about it, and like, why is the elder the one aware of the fire and no one else is? I think it's interesting to think of that fire as a smoky fire. You know, sometimes you don't notice the smoke and you start to inhale it without realizing necessarily what's going on. And so the kids could get lost in the smoke and the illusion, but also to look at it perhaps as it's a metaphorical, like fire of enlightenment, and that, you know, the elder realizes that he's hit a certain stage in his life and maybe practice, experience, whatnot, that he suddenly, you know, becomes enlightened by what's happening. Whereas the children are, you know, relatively immature. They don't experience this fire of enlightenment in the moment to get them to be concerned about exiting this problem. So I guess just another way of interpreting what that fire could symbolize and why only the elder seems to be aware of the fact that there even is a fire.
And that great sympathy with the elder in this circumstance, if we're imagining ourselves in that dream and we have, you know, we see all of these innocent children who are going to be burned up and killed, and we gotta save them. We gotta, like, you know, that sense of imperative and compassion, and oh my God, and they don't see what's coming, you know, and like Mary's saying, like they, lacking the ability to see where this is going, you know, kind of a very immediate, sense of only what's going on in the immediate present or proximity, and not being able to see what's coming. So, right, then we go on. So the elder said to himself, "My body and arms are strong. I can wrap the children in some robes and put them on a pallet or bench and carry them out of the house." But then he thought again, "This house has only one gateway and it is narrow and small. My children are young. Knowing nothing as yet of the danger, they are absorbed in their play. Probably they will be burned up in the fire. I must tell them why I am alarmed and warn them that the house is burning and they must get out quickly or be burned up in the fire." In accord with this line of thought, he called to his children, "Get out quickly, all of you." Although the father was sympathetic and tried to persuade them with kind words, the children, absorbed in their play, were unwilling to believe him and were neither alarmed nor frightened. They didn't even think about trying to escape. What's more, they did not understand what he meant by the fire, or the house, or losing their lives. They only kept running around playing, barely glancing at their father. Anybody have any sense of familiarity with this situation? You see beings suffering and you call it out and you say it, "Oh no," but they don't listen.
That's what we do, isn't it? We just keep playing.
The first thought that crossed my mind about this was that this is very much the reaction that's going on about COVID in much of our society. And so the question to myself is, well, what's a more skillful way that I can help people see a different reality of that?
I think about trying to get people to care about the climate crisis. You can start to doubt yourself when everybody's just da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, and you're the one going, "Wait, oh no, there's a fire, oh no." And they're like, yeah, whatever. There is not.
I just think about the Judeo tradition, Christian tradition, the prophet, the voice calling out in the wilderness, and how generally unwell things go for the prophets, and how they're ignored and persecuted for, you know, speaking truth to power. And that's kind of the same thing here. Is they just don't, they don't want to listen to it. And not only do they not want to listen to it, they don't even want to hear it. They just want you to go away. And
and now imagine, you know, we're one of the children, because again, in these kinds of dreamlike scenarios, it's very easy to kind of, you know, identify with a particular role, and that role is silly or bad or limited or something. But we're also the children ourselves. And, you know, what does it mean? What does it, as we're sitting there ignoring the warnings, why do we do that?
When I think of being the children, or one of the children, that there's also an element of being wholeheartedly present. The play that they're immersed in is their reality. And I mean, I don't know what to make of that, but that the idea that you could be that immersed, that you'd be oblivious, is actually kind of a desirable state. Kind of inconvenient that it's going to burn everybody up, but it,
right,
being that immersed seems like desirable kind of somehow.
Yeah, there's an innocence about it. It's not that the children are, they're not being willfully ignorant. They're not trying to hurt anybody. They're just enjoying themselves. So, what does the elder do? So then the elder thought, this house is already going up in a big blaze. If my children and I do not get out at once, we will certainly be burned alive. Now I have to find some skillful means to get my children to escape from this disaster. Knowing what his children always liked, and all the various rare and attractive playthings and curiosities that would please them, the father said to them, "The things you like to play with are rare and hard to find. If you do not get them when you can, you will be sorry later. A variety of goat carriages, deer carriages, and ox carriages are now outside the gate for you to play with. You must get out of this burning house quickly, and I will give you whatever ones you want." When they heard about the rare and attractive playthings described by their father, which were just what they wanted, all of the children, eagerly pushing and racing with each other, came scrambling out of the burning house. Oh, I was thinking about how we need to translate this for modern times, right? Goat carriages, probably not going to thrill too many kids today. But those of you who have kids or have grandkids or whatever, are teachers, what we get kids like scrambling out of a burning house?
So instead of yelling fire, what you do is you yell ice cream outside, and they go.
Or something like, technology, something to do with technology, if they're all currently wrapped up in, you know, the techno mystique, something like that would be
and
very
just released the iPhone 14. Yes. And there's 30 free iPhone 13s.
Right.
Out on the, they're handing them out.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I was trying to think of things that I could like tell my students, like, oh, this is outside, like, go get it, you know, like, oh my gosh, I just got a free PS5 that's not supposed to be released till December, and there's a beta version of it outside, go get it. But, you know, one of the things, and I had a conversation, a really long conversation with a friend of mine about this the other day, about those Generation Z kids. So much of their lives are lived online that, like, if you have a phone or you have a computer, everything they want is in that thing.
Wow.
You know, I have students who it's like, what do you like to do? And they're like, TikTok. I hope people know what that is. And you're like, that's not a thing to do. That's, you sit on your phone and you watch little 30-second videos of people around the world, like, posting videos onto the thing. But they, I have students who spend hours. And, like, I don't even know what you would say, like, if that is their life. And I have students who that is their life.
Well, that would, then it would be, like, one of the stars of TikTok or YouTube, one of these like incredibly like viral folks.
But it's all in the machine.
That's
like
true. That's true.
That's
would they even care about meeting them in person?
Exactly. It does. It, you know, and so that's one thing. And we were having this conversation, like, what does that mean that like all these kids all like, cause what they want exists in the internet. And they want more followers on the internet. They don't care if like their best friend down the street likes them, you know, their neighbor knows who they are, but they care if they have like a million followers around the world. And so it's really interesting. We've gotten to this very strange place, I feel, in society where it's like, it's still wrapped up in fame. It's still wrapped up in greed. It's still wrapped up in money, but it's almost become immaterial. It's immaterial fame and money and greed. It's very, I don't know what to do with that. I've been thinking about that a lot the last several years, and I don't know. I don't have any answers. So
you have to cut the connectivity inside and say, oh, we've got bars and Wi-Fi out there.
Ruth Ann, were you going to say something?
Oh, yes. It's true. Children like new, but if you say, well, you're going to be the star, the next video on TikTok, but you have to go out the gate. Secretly, children want the agenda. They want to know what's happening next, that somehow they have a picture, a part of it. They want that security, but in the individuality right now, they want to be on the next video. So I think giving them that package of security by saying, you know, you're next, you're the next star, because in this individual focus world, that's what we all in a way want to hear.
So the children come out of the house and the father's just made this up on the fly, right? I mean, there aren't goat carriages and deer carriages outside the house, but it says he's really rich. So when they all come out, he makes them all like these amazing, like even better than they expected. They all get the same carriage. Because part of this idea is that the idea is that the Buddha in his previous teachings had gotten sentient beings to give up their attachment to the world of samsara, to the world of pleasure and desire and fame and all that. To give up their attachment to that by promising them, if you will, kind of like spiritual goodies. So he said, you know, so there were these different paths, like he explained in earlier Buddhism, if you do this, then you will, you know, achieve this, and then you will be freed from suffering, and you will have this great insight. And he had these different ways of describing the teaching. And so in the Lotus Sutra parable, the goat carriage, deer carriage, ox carriage stands for the three different vehicles. So the vehicle of the like original Buddhists who were just looking for nirvana, and then the Pratyeka Buddha vehicle, and then the Buddha vehicle, and but then basically the point is they're all one. However you get there, however you get out of the house, you're out of the house. So it really doesn't matter. So that's kind of the religious message. But the children are thrilled, right? They're thrilled with these great carriages. And the point is that the father, he kind of told a falsehood, but it was okay because he was doing it for the well-being of his children. So it was like the Buddha, maybe he didn't really reveal his whole teaching early on, and he's only doing it now in the Mahayana Sutras, but that was just because he cared about us. So that's the kind of sectarian aspect of that story, but it's very clear reading the rest of this chapter that, you know, there is a clear interpretation of the meaning of this parable. And as we were talking about, the house is the threefold world. I say the world of desire, form, and formlessness. So really that's either there's different ways of describing existence in the Buddhist cosmology. This is one of them where kind of humans are in the realm of desire, but then in the heavenly realms, you even get to this realm of formlessness, like spiritual, great spiritual development, but that is still just part of this world. So the house is that world, this world that is impermanent. And so later on in the chapter, it says, the Buddha sees how living beings are scorched by the fires of birth, old age, disease and death, anxiety, sorrow, suffering, and agony. Moreover, because of the five desires and the desire for wealth, they undergo all kinds of suffering. Because of attachment to desire and striving, they endure much suffering in this life and later will suffer in a purgatory or as animals or hungry spirits. Even if they are born in a heaven, or among people, they will experience many kinds of suffering, such as the suffering of poverty and hardship, the suffering of separation from what they cherish, or the suffering from encountering what they hate. Absorbed in their pleasures, living beings rejoice and amuse themselves without knowing or seeing or being alarmed or frightened. And never being dissatisfied, they never try to liberate themselves. In the burning house of this threefold world, they run about here and there, and though they encounter great suffering, they are not disturbed by it. So, this can seem like a pretty negative view of life. All the stuff that we love about our lives, all the things that we enjoy, our family, our friends, our pleasures, our homes, our pastimes, delicious food and travel, gardening, entertainment, music, athletics, artistic expression, enjoying nature, all of the things that we love, right? In this metaphor, these are all playthings in this burning house. And our attachment to them keeps us in the burning house where we'll inevitably end up suffering and dying. So and there's no denying that that's part of the Buddhist message, but I think rather than going with a really literal interpretation and then reacting to it, like whether that story appeals, I imagine for most of us, that's like, I don't know, that, I mean, that, yeah, that points to a certain aspect of truth, but it doesn't tell the whole truth of my life. I mean, so rather than going with a really literal interpretation, you know, once again, kind of exploring the implications of this parable with some more curiosity and openness, as if this was a dream we had, that this is this dream, you know, this is us telling ourselves something. So not that we have to reject our lives and all enjoyment is bad. What is it asking us? And these are some of the things that I thought of. As we enjoy our lives, are we missing something? As we take delight in our lives, do we forget how impermanent and ephemeral everything actually is? Are we so busy taking pleasure in our lives that we neglect spiritual work, preparing ourselves to face the inevitable old age, disease, loss, and death that all of us are going to face, and to be able to face that with some dignity and equanimity? In the midst of enjoying our lives, do we miss the destruction and danger around us? Do we see only the aspects of our world that we like and ignore the decay? Are we caught up in concern for ourselves like the child, instead of taking responsibility for the safety and welfare of other beings like the father? And is this world of pleasure really what we think it is? Or is it inherently a treacherous place? Think of the consumption of industrialized societies and the pursuit of comfort, pleasure, and wealth, and how our planet is literally heating up and in many places actually burning because of it. And yet we continue as usual, oblivious to what's going on. And then what does coming out of the burning house look like? We think it means renouncing all the pleasure in our lives. You know, living a, I don't know, a pleasureless, bland, joyless existence of sacrifice and spiritual discipline or something like that. So just like the children, we won't want to give up what is the only source of happiness that we know. But then when we come out, what is it like when we come out? You know, then again, that kind of exploration of the imagery, right? We're no longer constrained in the house. We're no longer stuck in this house that only has one exit. We're outside. I picture kind of a beautiful day. There's actually, you know, rewards. We have everything we need. We're safe. We don't have to, and we're not, our happiness isn't dependent on like not noticing things that are going on. So outside the house is a completely different perspective. So I guess I'll leave it there. We have about 5 minutes to have a little bit of a chat. If anybody has any thoughts or questions to wrap things up.
I think what came to my mind through all of that story and imagining my dream of that is just because it's been on my mind, maybe it's just realizing that old age, sickness, and death, we're all subject to that, and it's not something we can escape, and it will happen. And like you say, we can be ignoring it as it's happening, or how am I preparing am I preparing by renouncing things? The Buddha left home. His parents wanted him to stay and be safe and guarded, like we want our children. We want them to have everything, but he left because he saw that, and then he tried the renunciation, like, I don't want any of this, I won't, you know, that'll make it all right. But the preparing of that saying, I don't know who, but, you know, the cup is already broken. Mm. So for me, just to sit with the fact that, yes, it's going to happen. How can I prepare? I don't know what I can necessarily prepare for, except these things will happen, are happening, and it's already there somehow, right? It's already happened, and that's how I prepare.
Mm. Thank you.
And that's about as far as I can think.
I like it.
That's kind of thinking about this in terms of the Western tradition with Plato's allegory of the cave. And, you know, the person goes outside and sees what's there and returns to the cave and tries to tell everybody what it's like out there, and nobody wants to listen to him. And in fact, he's beaten and killed. And that kind of reminds me of this story here from the Buddhist tradition.
It makes me wonder what kinds of stories I can tell myself as skillful means to move myself along a spectrum.
And I also find it encouraging in a way. It's like however you get yourself out of that house, right? So, you know, if what you really want out of Buddhism is like an enlightenment experience so you can be really cool, okay. I don't know. If you meditate because you want your friends to think you're cool, okay. I mean, like, in a way, it's like as long as you're getting out of the house.
yeah, for sure.
I mean, sometimes what I tell myself actually is, because maybe my plaything is projects, and I'm busy working on something. I don't disturb me. I'm working on this project. I'm going to improve this thing. I'm fixing this floor beam. Never mind that the house is on fire. And sometimes what I tell myself is like, well, if you do this thing, you'll be much more efficient when you work. So, you know, it's like using our desires to fuel our practice in a way. Mm-hmm. I can only see part of you, but I mean a subset of you, but raise your hand if this was like the first time you heard this parable. Cool. That's kind of fun to think that I introduced that. Yeah. All right. Let me close with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Domyo.
Thank you.